A senior member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mohammed al-Houthi, has slammed the recent U.S. arms sale to Saudi Arabia, saying it confirms the contradiction in Biden's administration when it comes to Yemen. In a tweet, al-Houthi said the arms sales once again prove that the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden had no real intention to stop the support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen.
America.
The United States is leading the war on Yemen and supports the Saudi-led coalition logistically and militarily. Washington's claims that it would stop the war on Yemen are incorrect, and the evidence for that is the continuation of the U.S. support for terrorist groups across the country. And this was proved through what the Yemeni army found in Al-Qaeda weapons warehouses with USAID logos.
Observers say Biden's promises to stop the war on Yemen have been nothing but lies to gain more votes in the elections. They say the new U.S. missiles sold to Riyadh will be used to bomb Yemenis and fighter jets such as F-15 and not as defensive weapons, contrary to what Washington claims.
The pre-election statements of the U.S. administration were only aimed at winning more votes, and the promises that the support for the Saudi regime and the war on Yemen would be halted were false. The U.S. administration proved that it supports the Saudi regime and that it only seeks to earn more money. The new deal is for offensive weapons, so the new U.S. administration is directly contributing to killing more Yemenis.
Saudi Arabia, with Washington's support, launched a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015. Over the years, the kingdom has used internationally prohibited weapons, including the U.S. cluster bombs, to target residential areas, according to the Cluster Ammunition Monitor.
Yemenis have long been accusing the U.S. of being the main supporter of the brutal Saudi-led war on their country. People here say they will continue to support Yemen's armed forces, as the armed struggle seems to be the only way to force Riyadh to stop its years-long war and siege. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Hundreds of anti-establishment protesters linked to the global hacktivist group Anonymous near the British Houses of Parliament under heavy police presence in a demonstration dubbed the Million Mask March.
They have a long list of grievances, from the government's performance on the climate crisis to its response to the pandemic to infringement of civil liberties, as well as its support for military intervention abroad.
It's all corruption. It's all fakery as well. They benefit from wars. We don't. We wouldn't have a war. All of these cenotaphs and everything, yeah, we care about the people of our families who have died, but none of these people would have voted for any war, any war. The governments do that, and we have to go around, you know, like, praising them up or doing what they say. No. No.
The event happens on the same date every year, the 5th of November, a date associated with an attempted attack on Parliament in 1605. But instead of the traditional burning of an effigy of one of the culprits by the name of Guy Fawkes and a bonfire each year, the group don masks made popular by the novel and movie V for Vendetta. They say they're symbolic of standing up to power. They also wear them to protect their identities, to remain anonymous. To their supporters, they're freedom fighters or digital Robin Hoods. Among the crowd, the Palestinian flag, and supporters of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, jailed in the UK.
As you've seen with Julian's case, it's the judiciary system. The whole system is corrupt from the roots. You have political prisoners. You have a war on the free press and independent journalists. I know a journalist here who's been arrested before just for filming the police, the criminality. We're not, if anyone thinks we live in a democracy, they really need to wake up. They need to wake up. We're not in a democracy. Democracy has several pillars. One of them is free press. One of them is the right to assemble, free speech. All of these are dead.
The mostly peaceful Million Mask March started in 2003 and has grown bigger in number. A grassroots group that says it aims to shed light on government corruption and protect liberty. Saeed Purizza, London.
The United States has approved a potential weapons sale worth hundreds of millions of dollars to Saudi Arabia. On Thursday, The Pentagon said the proposed sale of 280 advanced air-to-air missiles was approved by the State Department in late October. The deal is valued at up to $650 million. The State Department said the sale is fully consistent with the administration's pledge to co-lead with diplomacy to end the conflict in Yemen while also ensuring Saudi Arabia has the means to defend itself. Yemen's Ansarullah movement reacted, saying the arms sales prove that U.S. administration has no real intention to stop the Saudi onslaught on Yemen. This is seen as the first major arms sales to Riyadh since President Joe Biden took the helm at the White House. But such weapons transfer is not limited to the current administration. In May 2017, former President Donald Trump signed a mega weapons sales deal worth $110 billion in a meeting with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The recent deals have made Saudi Arabia become the largest importer of American arms and munitions. According to a report by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, 1/4 of America's arms exports go directly to the kingdom. The report also says that between 2016 and 2020, Saudi weapons purchases only from the United States accounted for 79% of the country's total arms imports. Many believe the U.S. weapon sales to Saudi Arabia serves no one but arms manufacturing companies.
These are offensive weapons to be used against the resistance in Yemen, so it should absolutely be condemned. And the violation of President Biden promising to lead with diplomacy, and once again, its weapon sales, which benefit Raytheon and benefit the Saudi monarchy, but no one else.
But the United States is not the only country that provides Saudis with weapons. The UK, Canada, Spain, France, Italy, and Germany are among other major exporters of weapons to the Al Saud dynasty. The arms supplies to Saudi Arabia have already sparked global criticism, given the kingdom's devastating war on Yemen since March 2015. Anti-war and human rights organizations have long sounded the alarm over the loss of human lives as a result of the West-backed Saudi aggression on Yemen. It seems the U.S. and its Western allies have no concern for misery the Saudi-led coalition have been inflicting on Yemenis. They are rather concerned about petrodollars they receive in return for those weapons being used in the impoverished Arab country.
Last-minute high-level talks in Paris to avert French sanctions on the United Kingdom did not produce any breakthrough, but both sides have agreed to continue discussions. A dispute over fishing boat licensing surprisingly ballooned into swift threats of sanctions and bans on using French ports unless London backed down. The row only concerns about 200 French fishing boats, some of which may be unable or unwilling to prove that they have not been fishing illegally in UK waters. The extremely low economic impact of the dispute has many saying the affair has become overly politicized, with French President Emmanuel Macron posturing ahead of re-election next spring, and the UK with their own questionable motives.
We see the economic problems the UK is having after Brexit, with shortages of gas and goods that appear rather serious. This dispute allows their government to focus attention elsewhere. But fishermen of both nations always have an interest in finding harmony together and sharing natural resources.
But the dispute does reveal the complex and long-lasting nature of the Brexit secession. Analysts say that as the UK's largest trading partner, the European Union holds the best cards. Tougher customs checks, which have not been implemented since Brexit, could cause major delays for British companies and costs which far outweigh sales of fish. France's Prime Minister recently shocked many when he asked the head of the European Commission to, quote, show that it is more damaging to leave the Union than to stay in it. The openly punitive stance has many saying it's an unabashed method to keep countries in the European Union, not by persuasion, but by intimidation.
The EU still doesn't exclude the use of sanctions, but they have consistently been in favor of more negotiations. Our government has said they will follow the lead of the Brussels. So many French fishermen have a real feeling of injustice and of being neglected. We certainly hope our government will put pressure on London, because we cannot go on like this with major losses.
Many expect Brexit to become a perpetual problem in UK-EU relations. And with France, sometimes an ally, sometimes a competitor, but always a neighbor, bilateral relations are likely to get more strained as Brexit solidifies into permanence. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Former prosecutor, anti-corruption maverick, and political novice Yoon Suk-yeol Friday won the nomination to run for president of South Korea for the Conservative People Power Party.
The South Korean people, who want to restore fairness and common sense in our society, have chosen me, a political novice. Instead of happiness, I feel a sense of responsibility and duty to achieve a change of government.
Former provincial governor Lee Jae-myung won the Democratic Party nomination October 10th and proposes a universal basic income among several liberal policies.
Rooting out unfairness, inequality, and corruption, and making a wealthy country where workers are respected are the clear and stern commands from the public.
Early polling shows the candidates running neck and neck.
I support Yoon Suk-yeol because I think that the government of this country ridiculing people should be replaced as soon as possible because lies after lies continue.
I support Lee Jae-myung because he has gone through very difficult times and overcome everything by himself to get where he is now. And he is open and above board as well as firm.
The two main candidates for president of South Korea, conservative Yoon Suk-yeol and Democrat Lee Jae-myung, clash on a number of issues, including North Korea policy. Lee favors peace-building engagement with Pyongyang, whereas Yoon advocates strengthening the alliance with the United States through regular military exercises. South Korea's presidential election is slated for March 9th next year, with the winner set to serve a single five-year term. Frank Smith, Seoul.
France has been shocked by a report which found that 20% of all the nation's hospital beds have been closed since the start of the pandemic. That total number of closed beds is twice as many as in 2019. Which also reveals that hospitals have been running at under capacity for some time. Unions gathered to clarify the situation, and they said it's even worse than it seems. The 20% number includes private hospitals, but it's public hospitals which have seen their funding cut almost annually since 2009.
As recently as the year 2000, France's medical system was ranked number one in the world by the United Nations. That claim can no longer be made following more than a decade of austerity, and perhaps no group has protested as often in recent years as medical professionals.
It's not only the lack of resources which is keeping hospitals underutilized or even closed, but also a lack of medical personnel. Studies show that during the age of austerity, public jobs, once eliminated, are not returning, even in hospitals during a once-in-a-century pandemic. What unions repeatedly accused is that the coronavirus is being instrumentalized by France's neoliberals to accelerate their open and long-standing goal of defunding public services even amid the corona instability.
We have this conviction that the government is manipulating corona because they were forcing the cuts before corona. Only the cuts are now coming even faster. In the middle of a pandemic, hospitals are being closed and services are no longer being offered, from our biggest and best public hospitals to smaller ones.
For public medical professionals, working conditions and pressures have dramatically worsened over the last 20 months, causing many to quit and turn over to the private sector. Unions say many of those resigned posts also never get refilled. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
Morning. Morning.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Kavit Afwai. When it comes to Iran's sanction-lifting talks with the P4 plus one group of countries, Iran has made its stance clear, from sanctions removal to the U.S. assuring and guaranteeing that it won't pull out of the deal again. But the U.S. has not given any assurances on neither, even though talks are set to resume on November 29. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at whether these talks are doomed to fail and whether it has any chances of success.
Iran's nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, has been in the spotlight for quite some time now, after the U.S., in May 2018, unilaterally withdrew from it and reinstated sanctions on the Islamic Republic. In recent months, all eyes have been on Iran to see what approach it takes over the JCPOA after the country's new administration, led by President Ebrahim Raisi, came to power in August.
We support the negotiations that guarantee our national interests, but Iran will not tie its economy and the lives of its people to the negotiations, nor will it allow negotiations for the sake of negotiations. We will not let the negotiations become attritional.
When the administration of President Joe Biden took office in January, Iran and the remaining parties to the JCPOA held six rounds of talks in the Austrian capital before they were suspended in June due to Washington's failure to remove the sanctions. The U.S. and its Western allies exerted pressure on Iran over the past months to resume the talks, but Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said Iran will first review the previous Vienna negotiations and then start talks with Russia, China, the UK, France and Germany, known as the P4 plus 1 group. Just last week, Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri Kani said Iran and the EU agreed that Tehran and the P4 plus 1 start talks on November 29th. He stressed that the talks should result in the removal of sanctions on Iran. The terminology that the Iranian official has used for the upcoming talks attaches significance to Tehran's approach towards the JCPOA. The term start conveys the message that Iran seeks to begin result-oriented negotiations. Talks with the aim of removing sanctions indicates that the revival of the JCPOA and the U.S. return to the deal is not of substantial importance to Iran. What matters is the removal of all sanctions under various titles in action and not on paper. The U.S. has been trying to push Iran to succumb to its demands via the so-called maximum pressure campaign that was launched by the Trump administration following its unilateral JCPOA pullout. But such a pressure campaign has backfired, since Iran has strengthened its defense capabilities, advanced its nuclear program, and begun to enrich uranium to the 60% level. Now, the ball is in the court of the U.S. and its Western allies. They should decide before November 29th on whether they want to take a lesson from the so-called maximum pressure campaign, which top White House officials have explicitly branded as a failed policy, or go on with their anti-Iran agenda. The new Iranian government believes that national interests will be achieved by increasing the country's power. What is certain for now is that the speed of Iran's enrichment shows that the country will not accept restrictions on its nuclear activities in case of non-compliance by the United States.
Well, guests joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, journalist, political analyst, and author Daniel Lazar joins us from New York. Also joining us, political analyst and professor of American Studies at the Faculty of World Studies at the University of Tehran, Fuad Azadi.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. With Zadi, I'm going to start with you, and perhaps I'm going to set the tempo to this spotlight program from a quote from the head of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, who has said, quote, "The U.S. president, lacking authority, is not ready to give guarantees. If the current status quo continues, the result of the negotiations is clear." Tell us what he means by that.
Well, he basically is talking about one of the difficulties that exist in the negotiations that happened in Vienna, the six rounds of negotiations. And the problem was that the Iranian side was saying that if we reach an agreement, how would we know whether the current administration, the Biden administration, or the next administration will actually stay in the agreement? That's a legitimate question, because we had the Trump administration just decided to leave the agreement after Iran had done what Iran needed to do under the agreement. So the Obama administration got all the concessions that they wanted from Iran, and then they then many of the things that they were supposed to do under the agreement. And then you had the Trump administration that left the agreement altogether. So it's a legitimate question on the Iranian side whether this is going to happen again. Because as they say in the United States, if you fool me once, shame on you. If you fool me twice, shame on me. And Iranians are not fooled, so they don't want to face similar situation that they experienced during the Trump administration, given the fact that Biden may not run in 2024, given his difficulties. And Trump is gaining popularity. So he may run again, he may become president, or some other Trump crony like Mike Pompeo may run and get elected. So that's the basic question that Iran has. That if we go back to the agreement, do get rid of all the advances that Iran has made, follow the spirit and the letter of the agreement the way Iran did in 2015 until 2018, how would we know if the other side would do their part, or whether they will just leave the agreement? That's a question that Iran has. The answer that the Biden administration gives is we don't know. They are not giving any guarantees for the next administration. They are not even giving any guarantees for their own administration, citing the U.S. Congress, citing other excuses. So when Mr. Shamkhani talks about U.S. president that doesn't have any authority, that's what he basically is talking about. That the U.S. president cannot do anything to for the other side, for the Iranian side, to believe that they're actually going to follow the agreement.
Sure. Well, Daniel Lazar, we're also looking, I mean, in one respect, what Dr. Azadi said there about perhaps Trump running and maybe him or somebody else winning, like Pompeo, would lead to maybe the U.S. pulling out of the deal. But we're looking at also at current responses coming, like from Senator Ted Cruz, a Republican who he recently tweeted about this Iran deal, said it is a 100% certainty that any future Republican president will tear it up. So when you have that kind of statement coming, doesn't Iran have a right to then have a question mark when it comes to this deal actually sticking and then wanting a guarantee on it?
Well, I must say the Americans, and I include myself among them, are a bit puzzled by this Iranian response, because it's axiomatic that a new president will have the power. He's not bound by any previous administration. If he wants to abandon a treaty, he's free to do so. If the UN wanted to walk out of if the U.S. wanted to walk out of the UN tomorrow, it could do so. If Trump wants to do it 4 years from now, there's nothing to stop him. But I think the real issue is that I don't think there's any chance that Biden will re-enter the agreement. Biden is increasingly weak. His poll ratings are plummeting. He's very unpopular. His performance is incompetent in office. I think it's clear that it's increasingly clear the Republicans will regain the White House in 2024. And meantime, Biden just shows no interest in a serious approach to the negotiations in Vienna. He won't do anything to reduce sanctions or much less eliminate them. And the official U.S. position is to make additional demands on Iran, which have nothing to do with a nuclear accord, and the U.S. is insisting that Iran agree to these demands as a precondition for re-entering the 2015 agreement. So the U.S. position is impossible from the outset, and from the start I have been completely pessimistic about any chances of a Biden administration re-entering that agreement. I've been saying that since before there was a Biden administration, and when Joe Biden was only a candidate, was still running on the campaign trail. I argued then, and I argue now, that there is simply no chance of the U.S. re-entering that agreement.
Yeah, that's true. And Fouad Azadi, that is the case when it comes to what our guest has said in terms of him being insistent and very pessimistic about this actually happening. But there's a question mark here, Fouad Azadi. I don't know if you can answer this or not. And that is both sides know, at least Iran knows. I shouldn't say both sides. Iran knows what it needs. Iran knows what it wants. Iran has voiced what it wants. So before the negotiations start, Iran's stance, at least, is very clear. Given the fact that the U.S. knows that, and given the fact that there's going to be talks, does that mean that there's a chance of success? Because if there wasn't, and Iran has relayed its stance, then why would the U.S. want to start negotiations, in direct negotiations, I should say, through the P4 plus one for sanctions lifting?
Well, I don't think the U.S. is interested in negotiating with Iran to lift sanctions. They like sanctions. They have an addiction to sanctions. They are sanctioning over 30 countries as we speak. It's part of the U.S. government foreign policy to sanction people that don't agree with U.S. domination, whether in their own countries or elsewhere. They are negotiating with Iran because they like JCPOA, but they like JCPOA when Iran does what Iran is supposed to do. And they don't like JCPOA when they are supposed to do their part. So they very much speak about JCPOA in terms that are quite strong. They like it, but they like it when Iran implements it. Another reason they are interested in Vienna talks is to create a consensus among P4 plus one countries, the Europeans plus Russia and China, to basically create a united front against Iran. That's the basic idea. The Europeans generally follow U.S. foreign policy, especially when there is a strong demand from the United States. That's what they have done since World War II. And the hope of the U.S. government is to at least make Russia and China stay quiet and go along with whatever U.S. and Europeans are designing to do. That's the basic idea. And then there's a lot of propaganda involved. So yesterday, when Jake Sullivan was talking to the U.S. media, he says that we are ready to go back whenever Iran does. So that basically gives them a talking point. Biden, during his campaign, talked about returning to the nuclear agreement, and he could do so on the first day that he became president, the same day he returned to the Paris Accord. And the reason he hasn't done that is because of what's going on inside the U.S. government and the pressure that the U.S. government is getting from the Israelis and the Saudis and the Israeli lobby and people like that.
Can you please expand for us more about that, what our guest, Tafuda Zadi, said, Daniel Azar, about Israel, Israeli lobby, and what they're doing within the U.S. administration?
Yeah, first of all, I agreed with every single word your other guest uttered, and he's completely correct. And the U.S. is under intense pressure from Israel and the Saudis. And as we know, I mean, Israel, you know, has huge power in Washington, and it has, you know, the Saudis have economic influence. The Israelis have huge amounts of political and ideological influence, and that is really quite decisive. It's not to say that Biden is a tool of the Israelis 100% of the time, but let's just say he's a tool of the Israelis 95% of the time. And so the Israelis are putting intense pressure on the White House not to re-enter the JCPOA. They're calling all their allies into the fight. And Biden is just extremely unlikely to buck that pressure, especially now that his polls are plummeting. He's increasingly unpopular, and therefore he's very weak.
Fudazadi, so you know, we got to look at different aspects of the sanctions lifting talks with the P4+1, and looking at what may happen and how the response should come from the U.S. side when it comes to, for example, the sanctions being lifted. What is it that the other side needs to do, and in particular the U.S.? Thing they need to do, as one analyst has stated, is to offer speedy relief from these sanctions, but also find a mechanism to reassure the rest of the world and financial institutions that it's okay to do business with Iran. Now, my question to you is, when the deal was signed back in 2015, originally, and everything was okay then, the U.S. still went around and said, don't do business with Iran, and it still promoted an air of doubt for anybody, company-wise or country-wise, to do business with Iran. How can they reassure Iran of that this time around if things were to go in a positive direction?
Well, it's not really complicated. If the United States wanted to return to the agreement, they could return to the agreement. They could do it. Biden could do it on the first day of his presidency, could do it today. And by returning to the agreement, it means that they would implement sanctions relief sections of the agreement. Because after all, it was the Trump administration that caused all these difficulties by leaving the agreement. And then the Biden administration people who were not in the government at that time criticized Trump for doing so. So if the Biden administration wanted to return to the agreement, they can do it today. But they're not doing that. They're not lifting sanctions. They're actually putting more sanctions on Iran. They used to say that Iran wants to build a nuclear weapon. About 10 days ago, Antony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, issued a statement sanctioning people in Iran and companies in Iran that are building drones that are, as you know, they're not weapons of mass destruction. So once Iran gave a lot of concessions on its nuclear, peaceful nuclear program, it seems they like that, and now they want concessions on other military equipment in Iran that have nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction. So that's the basic problem that Iran has, that no matter what you give the United States, they come back and want more. And this is what Wendy Sherman, who is now Under Secretary of State and during the Obama administration was the lead negotiator on the U.S. side, said a few months ago in the U.S. Congress that 2021 is not 2015. And by that, what she means is that in 2015, had some concerns, and we got a nuclear agreement, and those concerns went away. Now, in 2021, they want new things from Iran. That's what she basically implies. And you put yourself on the side of the Iranian government, and you realize that last time you signed an agreement with the United States, they didn't do what they were supposed to do, and they left. And this time, they want more concessions without doing the things that they were supposed to do in 2015 and later on. So that's why you see a lot of hesitations in Tehran. They're going to Vienna for talks, but as you mentioned in the tweet of Iran's National Security Council Secretary, that they're not very optimistic about the United States because you know how the U.S. government behaves. And so that's quite clear to them.
Okay. Thank you very much. Well, unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. We'll have to end it there. Let me thank our guest, journalist, political analyst, and author, Daniel Lazar from New York. A pleasure for your contribution there. And Dr. Fouad Azadi, thank you so much, political analyst and professor of American Studies at the Faculty of World Studies at the University of Tehran. Thank you so much. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From the Covered Halfway and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, as a reminder, we talked about Imam Khomeini's message, which he had issued to the seminaries and ulema in the last month of his life. We discussed the Imam's views on the struggles of ulema and their sacrifices in the way of God, to awaken people and to confront oppression on the one hand and sanctimony on the other. The Imam has pointed out that the true ulema have always been supportive of the downtrodden and the oppressed strata against tyrannical and puppet rulers. We also discussed Imam Khomeini's warning in his testimony to the seminaries and great ulema against deviation. Stay tuned to follow the discussion. One of the important axes that have been stressed in Imam Khomeini's testimony is the necessity of new organization in the structure of seminaries. The Imam, as a pioneer in this field, believed that if the seminaries did not embark on reform and development under the supervision of the sources of emulation and great ulema, others would step in for the purpose with wicked goals. This had been experienced during the rule of illiterate and ruthless Reza Khan, whose real aim was to obliterate ulema and Islam in Iran. Therefore, during the era of Grand Ayatollah Muhammad Hossein Borujerdi, Imam Khomeini strove to reform the seminaries, especially that of Qom. But he faced obstructionism of opportunities and dogmatic elements who had infiltrated the ranks of clergymen under the guise of benevolent persons. Imam Khomeini was very concerned about reformation of the structure of seminaries, even when he was in exile. Imam Khomeini's warnings during the tough times in Najaf would arouse committed ulema and young students to reform the seminaries. He made all these efforts alongside his struggles for the Islamic Revolution. He told the students and ulema, "You will be able to remove these corruptions and difficulties and thwart their colonial schemes only through self-expurgation, preparation and proper order. If you do not reform yourselves, do not become equipped and do not make order and discipline rule over your lessons and life, you will be, God forbid, doomed to destruction in the future. Before losing the opportunity and before the enemy gains access to all your religious and scientific affairs, ponder, wake up and rise up. In the first phase, embark on self-expurgation, purification, and reformation. Become equipped and orderly. Set up order and discipline in seminaries. Do not let others come and make seminaries orderly. Do not let the enemies administer the seminaries with the pretext that these people are not qualified. They cannot do anything and they are a handful of jobless people who have gathered together in seminaries so that they would corrupt the seminaries in the name of order and reform, and would subjugate you. Do not give them pretext. If you become orderly and self-expurgated, and all your affairs are orderly, others would not have view upon you, and would not find way to infiltrate the seminaries and the community of clergymen. With the victory of the Islamic Revolution and foundation of the Islamic Republic in Iran, naturally the necessity of new organization in seminaries was highlighted more than ever. As the grounds were set for this purpose, Imam Khomeini was more sensitive on the issue. He writes in his testimony, "I recommend for all eras, especially the current era, as the schemes and plots have become faster and stronger, that the uprising for organization of seminaries is necessary and essential, so that the ulema and great figures would spend time and, through accurate program, preserve seminaries, especially the Qom Seminary and other great and important seminaries against ills in this juncture in time." Another serious concern of Imam Khomeini with regards to the ulema and seminaries was his high emphasis on safeguarding the traditional jurisprudence known as Fiqh-e-Jawahiri or Jawahiri jurisprudence. He writes in his historical message, "As for education and research in seminaries, I believe in the traditional jurisprudence and Jawahiri ijtihad and do not consider as permissible to disregard it. Ijtihad, independent reasoning on the basis of the Quran and Hadith, is correct on the same basis, but it does not mean that the jurisprudence of Islam is not dynamic. Time and place are two determining elements in ijtihad. What used to have an edict in the past, it seems that the same issue may get a new edict in terms of the relations ruling on politics, society, and economy of system. A jurisprudent should smartly and sharply guide a great Islamic and even non-Islamic society, and beside sincerity, God-wariness, and asceticism, which are worth a jurisprudent, should be really a prudent manager." Imam Khomeini points to this issue in his testimony too. "It is necessary that the respectable ulema and teachers not allow lessons that are related to jurisprudence and the jurisprudential seminaries of the grand ulema, which are the only way for preservation of the Islamic jurisprudence, to become deviated and try to increase precision, debate, discussion, and research every day. The traditional jurisprudence, which is the heritage of the righteous predecessors, and deviation from it will weaken the pillars of research and erudition, must be preserved and researches should be increased. Of course, programs will be prepared in other sciences concerning the needs of the country, and Islam and people should be trained in those fields." Dear listeners, next time, we will continue discussing Imam Khomeini's view.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. We'll be right back.